From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for AlMonitor.com, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor at National Journal. And here are the issues. A major attack by Kurdish forces, backed by American airstrikes, was launched against ISIS militants aimed at breaking the link between ISIS strongholds in Iraq and Syria. In Burma, the opposition National League for Democracy won a landslide election victory, including a majority, over the party of the military government. Russia circulated a new plan for Syria that would keep President Assad in power, and the fourth televised debate among Republican presidential candidates gave no indication that a single candidate is likely to break out and dominate the field, with the first voting 2.5 months away in Iowa. Well, let's start with this Kurdish attack. Barbara, is there reason for optimism here?
Yeah, definitely. It looks as though they've made some major inroads in the town of Sinjar. You may remember that the group that calls itself the Islamic State took over Sinjar and sent all of these members of a religious minority called the Yazidis fleeing into the mountains around there. This was at the beginning of the crisis over a year ago. They killed something like 5,000, made another 50,000 homeless. There were tales of rape and sexual slavery and horrible things. Well, the Yazidis joining with the so-called Peshmerga, the Kurdish militias, and aided by United States airstrikes, appear to have taken back much of the town of Sinjar. And as you mentioned in your intro, even more important, what this does is that it severs the main highway, Route 47, that connects the ISIS strongholds in Iraq with the ISIS strongholds in Syria. So this is big news.
Tom?
Well, I couldn't agree more with Barbara. This is big news. It also appears that it's an operation that is U.S.-backed, although the British are heavily involved in the air component of it, and it's working. And for a campaign that is not gone as well as the generals in Washington and the Obama administration has often said, this is a welcome dose of good news. It would appear that the Kurdish Peshmerga are doing very well, and they're being supplied, I think, a little more heavily with arms than the Obama administration was doing several months ago. So it seems to be coming together. This is going to be a long and drawn-out event. The former commander of U.S. forces in the region, now retired, John Allen, said in an interview the other day that it's quite possible that we will be fighting ISIS in all our lifetimes, indefinitely, permanently. But this is a positive development, at least.
John Allen, that I don't consider that optimistic. I mean, look, I'm pretty old, but I have children and grandchildren.
That was not positive, but this particular operation looks to be going very well.
You know, Barbara, one of the impediments to arming the Peshmerga was that the weapons had to be sent to the Iraqi government, which is not what you'd call one of the great functioning governments.
Well, also, frankly, the Peshmerga and the Kurds are not what you would call one of the great functioning governments. You know?
Well, they're better than the Iraqi government.
Yeah, that's true. But there's been a lot of infighting between the two main parties in Iraqi Kurdistan, the Kurdish Democratic Party and the PUK, I'm not sure what that stands for. But the president of the Kurdish Republic, Masoud Barzani, was supposed to undergo an election in August, and he didn't, and he stayed on. And there has been apparently problems in coordinating between the two Peshmergas. Peshmerga means those who face death, by the way. Mm. There are two Peshmergas, one for the PUK and one for the KDP, and they don't always talk to each other. So one of the reasons why this...
But they are fighting together now.
Not clear either which components are in the lead here, but one of the reasons that this action against Sinjar town had been delayed was because of a lack of coordination between these two parties and because of infighting within the Kurdish areas. On the other side of the line, you have America relying on Syrian and Turkish Kurds that are perhaps pressing down on the ISIS stronghold of Raqqa in Syria. And this opens up another kettle of fish because the Turks are not happy about the support the United States is giving to these Kurdish groups. I mentioned the Turkish Kurds. The Turkish government considers them terrorists, but they are active on that side. Still, when you look at the situation, you do have to say that the Kurds, whether they are in Iraq, Syria, or Turkey, are turning out to be the best U.S. allies against ISIS.
All right. Well, let's turn to something that is indisputably grounds for optimistic and for those of us who like democracy, and that is what happened in Burma. I think this was the first Burmese election, what, since 1991? Something like that, Tom. And the Democratic opposition has won an actual majority in the parliament, which means a really spectacular landslide over the military government.
Not just a majority, Fred, but a majority that even when the military by constitution is allowed to appoint a quarter of the legislature, the Democrats, the freedom-loving Democrats, will still have a majority after that. So unless the military decides to totally revert to previous form and stage a coup, I think this is a dramatic development, and I don't think they will do that. I think the level of support throughout Myanmar, also called Burma, it says everything you need to know, and I think even the generals understand that this is an idea, at least in Burma, whose time has come. And so you'll have to see how they behave going forward, but I think they will allow a democratic government to be formed.
Barbara, what should we call this? Should we call the country Burma? Should we call it Myanmar?
Well, it calls itself Myanmar, so I'll call it Myanmar.
Okay.
And actually, this election, I think they've had other elections, but you're referring to an election that took place in 1990. That was the last time that the National League for Democracy won a landslide.
Okay.
And Aung San Suu Kyi, the head of that party, was poised to become the leader of then Burma, now Myanmar. And the military intervened to prevent that.
Mm-hmm.
So what is very exciting about this is that even though she's not allowed by their constitution to become president, she will be the power behind the new president who will be chosen next year. And she's made that very explicit. She said, "The president will be told exactly what he can do. I make all the decisions because I'm the leader of the winning party." So there. The other thing that struck me was that the current president of the country, Thein Sein, sent his congratulations in a Facebook post. So this is not your grandfather's Burma.
No.
It's really quite remarkable how far they've come. And I agree with Tom. I mean, their isolation has been reduced. They've restored economic relations with the United States, so many other countries. And I don't think they're going to jeopardize that now.
Okay, let's take a short break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time, Saturdays and Sundays, on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Fred Barnes with Barbara Slavin and Tom DeFrank. And I have one more question about Burma or Myanmar, and that is, what was the U.S. role here? I know President Obama has congratulated the opposition party for its tremendous political victory, but how much of an impact did the American government have in reaching this point?
Well, I think the U.S. government has been politely and quietly leaning on the generals. And also, I think American economic aid to the country has also been increased. And the whole message is, look what isolation has done to your economy, to your people. And I think Myanmar sees neighbors like Vietnam surging ahead with U.S. support, and their economy is still a mess, although it's improving. And so I think the U.S. has quietly, under the radar, for the most part, encouraged democracy and made it clear to the generals that the U.S. is going to support the Democrats.
Has Tom got that right?
Yeah, I think this is a good object lesson for some neoconservatives who have been attacking the Obama administration over its policy toward Myanmar, Cuba, and Iran, you know, saying, oh, engagement, schmengagement, it doesn't work, right? Well, here's an example where engagement, you know, which was controversial, actually has shown that it can help in terms of democracy and human rights. So, I mean, the jury is still out on the other two, but but for this case, I think it has worked.
Okay. Let's turn to what Russia is up to in Syria. I mean, it does seem to me that any plan that that really starts out with we're keeping President Assad in power is a non-starter for all the other Syrian forces.
Well, Fred, the Russians are doing what the Russians and the Soviets before them have done for decades. They're kind of being very murky. I mean, they're not saying Assad has to survive any longer, which I would suggest makes President Assad very nervous.
Are but making a distinction between stay in power and survive, or
No, I'm just saying.
Not sure you should.
I think for as we've all discussed from these microphones before, I think for a variety of reasons, the West probably needs Assad to stay in power for a while longer because he is a polarizing force, but in some ways he's a bit of a stabilizing force. But I don't think the Russians are committed long-term to Assad. I think the Russians are doing what the Russians do, which they crave respect, they demand respect, they don't think they're sufficiently respected around the world, and they like to do things that tweak the nose of President Obama, who has had his troubles in Syria in terms of formulating a policy. So they're in the short run, the Russians calling for elections in 18 months and rewriting the Constitution, it all sounds fairly noble, but these are not freedom-loving Democrats in Moscow or Damascus. So it's posturing for leverage in the end game. And I think there will be some kind of a transition to a different kind of government. I wouldn't call it a democratic government, but to a less repressive government in Damascus. But this is just maneuvering for position at the moment. And the Russians have a big piece of the pie here at the moment.
What are they up to here? I mean, an election in 18 months? I'm for elections. I just don't believe that Syria is going to be ready for an election in 18 months where you actually have where everybody can vote and there are moderate forces there and so on, which they don't seem to be much of now.
Yeah, no, I think I agree. It's a non-starter. What they're trying to do now, frankly, is more important, which is to identify which of the opposition groups will be allowed to be part of the settlement. They're going to make up a list of organizations that are considered terrorist. And
this
that
is going to be done by whom?
This is being done by a very large group of nations, including the United States, Russia, Iran, Saudi Arabia, meeting again in Vienna. And if they can reach an agreement on which opposition forces will be allowed to take place and which are beyond the pale, that would be a start. No, there won't be an election, most likely, in 18 months. What you have to be able to do is work towards some sort of coalition, you know, that could bring some stability, some ceasefires, allow more humanitarian aid, stop the barrel bombing of people, which is what has been sending so many of them, you know, racing across the borders and on into Europe. So, you know, look, John Kerry, you know, who's spearheading this, he's the eternal optimist. Mm-hmm. But there are some principles that they've agreed on. And obviously Assad and what happens to him is you know, going to be sort of like Jerusalem with Middle East peace talks. That's going to be left for later because it's just too difficult right now to resolve.
Yeah, Tom, what do they do with Islamic State occupying, what, half of Syria?
A third, a half, a good chunk.
Well, they continue bombing them, hopefully, into oblivion, which is probably very optimistic. But they're trying, clearly, part of the plan is to try to establish something akin to safe zones here and there in Syria, but to continue to degrade, as President Obama still says, to degrade and ultimately destroy ISIS. So nobody's going to want to do business with ISIS, that's for sure. And so even the Russians, although I think their bombing campaign is directed less at ISIS than at opponents to Assad, are going to have to deal with ISIS in the long run as well.
Yeah, I don't mean doing business with ISIS. I mean, had to have a functioning Syria with ISIS, the Islamic State, controlling a huge chunk of Syria. It doesn't seem that you can really move on any plan that will lead to elections and so on.
Absolutely, yeah. That's ridiculous. Yeah. The emphasis now, U.S. is bombing the oil fields that ISIS controls, mm-hmm. To try to deprive them of revenue, which they're still able to get. By the way, they sell that oil to the Syrian government, so there's a kind of collusion between these two.
Which
is really interesting, or a symbiosis, mm-hmm. as John Kerry put it in a speech the other day, between these two groups.
Mm-hmm.
So they're bombing the oil fields and, as I mentioned earlier, supporting Kurdish groups that are going to be trying to expand their area and eventually moving on Raqqa, which is the capital of the caliphate in Syria. And then, of mm-hmm. course, the Mosul in Iraq is the center for ISIS there. So mm-hmm. the idea, I think, is to gradually move from both directions and squeeze these two centers of the caliphate.
I'm going to try to really simplify things here. Tom, should President Obama be pleased in the least bit with this Russian plan? I mean, is that they have one or not?
I don't think he's pleased. I mean, if the U.S. thought this was a viable plan, Obama would probably be a little more positive. But it is to mangle my metaphors here, it's a Potemkin village of diplomacy in Syria. The Russians are up to no good.
Okay.
Can I say one more word about Russia?
Yeah, quickly. Let me take a break first.
Sure,
I'll come back to you. Don't worry. It is time for another break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Welcome back. I'm Fred Barnes with Tom DeFrank and Barbara Slavin. Barbara?
Yeah, I had one more word about Russia. You know, we're dumping on Russia here, but the Russians have a lot of skin in this game now, and their military intervention has been quite significant. And, of course, there was a Russian airliner which apparently exploded over the Sinai Desert with the loss of life of all on board, looking very much now like it was ISIS retaliating against Russia. So this is not cost-free for them, and this is not the Soviet Union. They don't have infinite resources to throw into this fight. So I think it's more now about shaping the battlefield, so to speak, and gaining leverage on various sides for a political deal at some point to be cut. And, yeah, this plan is a non-starter, but, you know, it's the beginning of a process.
Okay. And let's talk about the Republicans in their fourth, this is Republican presidential candidates, of course, in their fourth televised debate. I think they're going to actually have seven more, because so they're just starting this process, too. But the audience still is huge. It's not 24 million that they had, I think, in the first one, but it was 13 million people. That's a lot of eyeballs watching these debates well ahead of the actual voting. I think this is three or four times what the audience they were getting for debates 4 years ago. Tom, what about this last debate? It was less raucous, more substantive. Some people said it was more boring, but it did have a large audience, but it didn't seem to change anything.
No, Fred, I think there's two things that strike me about this process. I can't remember a presidential campaign. I think you and I have now covered 13. I can't remember one of these where the field on either side has not really winnowed out this close to the first balloting in Iowa in January. I mean, you basically have six to eight people still, candidates still on the Republican side, and I'm beginning to believe, I've thought this for a while, that we're going to see another 1976, where Ronald Reagan took Gerald Ford to the convention in Kansas mm-hmm. City, and it was decided in back rooms wow. by a handful of votes, a couple of dozen votes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's going to happen here. This time they're going to be more than two candidates, Reagan mm-hmm. and Ford, with votes. You might have you might have six to eight.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's no clear-cut leader at the moment. Donald Trump and Dr. Ben Carson still command about half of the Republican vote at the moment. But the winnowing mm-hmm. process did not begin with this last debate. The other thing that I think is so struck at is there is a real fissure in the Republican Party on the questions of national security, national defense, and mainly involvement in the world, and immigration. There is a complete schism on immigration. And a very respected group, the Pew Research Group, recently concluded there will be 800,000 new voting-age Hispanics, or another way to say that is they will turn 18 and will be eligible to vote in the next year alone. So this, and a party that came out of the last election saying we got to fix our problems with Hispanics, certainly seem not to be doing that at the moment.
No, certainly Donald Trump, who is, I guess, basically tied with Ben Carson for the lead, at least in these polls, in the year before. It's 2.5 months before the Iowa caucuses, and these polls in the past have turned out not to be predictive, but Trump has held 25-30% in polls pretty consistently now. But I think this last debate did not help him, particularly when you get to foreign policy. He talked about the Pacific Trade Treaty, supported by President Obama and Republican leaders, and I thought he didn't know what he was talking about, Barbara.
Yeah, well, so I've seen some subsequent commentary suggesting what he meant to say was that somehow this agreement was going to help the Chinese. But, of course, as Rand Paul pointed out, China is not part of this treaty, and the whole point of the treaty actually is to shore up everybody else against China. So that was incoherent. And
that was a big point that he missed.
Yeah,
this is what the treaty's about.
Indeed. And then Ben Carson said that the Chinese were somehow involved in the fighting in Syria. So China tripped up both of them. I agree it was a more substantive debate, but there were some incredible bloopers. Jeb Bush said that small businesses were being destroyed or were falling apart at a greater rate than they were being created, which is incorrect. The moderators were so terrified of looking like they were contradicting anybody that they didn't even correct the obvious errors. But I agree with Tom. I mean, the schism over immigration, huge. Jeb Bush, I thought, had his finest moment when he went up against Trump and said, what you're suggesting is un-American. It would tear apart communities. And Hillary Clinton's people are high-fiving each other right now.
Well, what you're talking about is particularly that Trump has proposed a deportation force.
Yeah, of 11 million human beings.
Well, no, those are the people they're deporting. But, I mean, he wants to set up a special police force of sorts. Have I got this right, Tom?
Tens of thousands of police officers
will actually do the physical deporting.
And part of the problem here is that most of the illegal aliens in this country are concentrated in six states, but they're all over the place. So Trump says first we've got to find them, and then we've got to humanely get rid of them. Some estimates are that it would cost more than a half a trillion dollars to do this, and it's totally impractical. It's just it's lunacy, and it's not going to happen. George W. Bush used to say when he was president, "There's no way we're going to remove 11 million Americans, even if they're illegal." It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And so, but Trump and to a lesser extent Carson play on this issue because it is such a hot button issue for the most extreme components of the Republican vote. And Carson and Trump are protest candidates. They're playing to the anger out there among many Republicans who think their own party, much less the Democrats, have abandoned American principles. And so it's still totally up in the air. I have no idea where this is going to go, but I think you're going to have half a dozen at least candidates with hundreds of delegates in their back pockets going to Cleveland next year.
Well, and let me mention one other thing about Trump. Just because he's been this huge figure in the Republican presidential race. And he said one other thing, and I note before I mention it, that his following is pretty much a working class, lower middle class following among Republicans and what used to be called Reagan Democrats. But anyway, and what he said is wages are too high in this country. I don't know whether the other Republican candidates will jump on him about that. I don't think they have so far, but certainly if he were the nominee, the Democrats would.
It was stunningly out of touch with the situation in this country. And coming from someone who is as rich as he is and who brags about how rich he is, I thought it was particularly tone deaf.
But in any case, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent. for AlMonitor.com and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski and John Walker. I'm Fred Barnes, executive editor of the Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.